This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. In this week's episode, we feature the final installment of the series on the evolution of sport horse feeding with Dr. Joe Pagan. But before that, Vicky Hammers O'Neill presents our trainer's tip, which offers some ideas for transitions when crossing the diagonal. Vicky is a USDF certified instructor through fourth level, a bronze and silver medalist, a graduate of the L program, and a member of the Instructor Trainer Programs faculty. Hi Vicky, welcome to the program.
Thank you, it's nice to be here.
And you've got some great ideas this week, haven't you, to counteract some of the things that horses will anticipate already at the lower level. And horses can get pretty clever very quickly, can't they?
They absolutely do. I see it typically beginning at training three, which is the first time that the rider has to come onto the diagonal and ride a transition downward into the trot at X. And often the horse sees that open diagonal, takes a little bit of hold of the bridle, and wants to be in charge. So if you're finding that that's an issue, you need to look at a little bit where it's coming from. Is your horse drifting through the corner so that you turn onto the diagonal and you're not straight, and that gives the horse the opportunity to grab maybe the bridle and drift more? Or is he simply just losing his balance because he sees that nice open space and falling onto the forehand? So if you're finding that that's the issue, one of the easiest things to do is to ride the corner, and as you come onto the diagonal, rather than going straight, circle whichever lead you're on. If you're in left lead canter, for example, circle left, you'll be able to fit in about a 15-meter-ish to 17-meter circle, and then come back onto the diagonal. If you start the straight line and the horse tries to take over again, circle again. You can even ride the transition to trot on the circle and back to the canter. But if you do that two or three times and you interrupt the horse's, wow, there's the diagonal, it allows you to put the horse back on your aids and be more in charge of things. And then typically then the horse will stay with you to X so that you can ride a more balanced transition.
Right. Well, that, of course, is key, isn't it? Getting the balance and setting them up for this. So
absolutely.
Take us a little bit through the levels and the questions that are asked across those diagonals, Vicky.
Okay. Well, obviously that happens at training level three, and then it also happens in the first level test one and first level test two. By first level test three, you're now being asked to change leads through the trot over X, which is another different issue, because sometimes, even though you've worked very diligently and you now have your horse waiting for you as you turn onto the diagonal, as soon as the horse comes down to the trot and he figures out after a couple of transitions, oh, we're going to canter again, now he's trying maybe to take charge through the trot and back into the new lead of canter. And you can use a very similar exercise. You have the option to, you know, at first level three, your horse should be pretty good or approaching fairly good at schooling a 10-meter canter circle. So as you approach X, if you're finding that the horse is saying, I know what we're doing, you simply ride a canter circle to the direction of the lead. If you need a couple of them, you do a couple of them. And when you feel that the horse is waiting, transition downward into the trot. If then the horse says, I know the new canter lead is coming, you circle to the new direction. For example, if you've been in left canter and you've circled left a couple of times and you ride your transition to trot, now you circle to the right, let the circle set up the bend and the balance, and then ride the transition to the new lead and continue the diagonal. And you can even circle again as you're approaching the corner to the new lead if you're finding that the horse is still having the tendency to be strong. Sometimes I'll even have a rider go canter to trot to halt on the diagonal, and then back to the trot, and then the canter to the new lead. So it's basically what you're looking for is things that interrupt the horse's sort of mindset that, wow, I have this nice open diagonal, and I know we're going to go canter, trot, canter. I believe that somebody discussed riding into the corners in an earlier podcast, and certainly that is something that you need to take with you when you're schooling pieces of the test, and be willing to go back and make whatever corrections might be necessary if you're losing the half halt before the corner and the horse is trying to take charge. Go back and you work your corner exercises so that you really feel that the horse is waiting for you before the corner, during the corner, and after. And it's important, I think, that you separate the corner from what's happening next. I think there can be a tendency, especially with riders that are a little less experienced at test riding, that everything gets in a hurry and you rush through the corner, and so the corner just becomes sort of this sweep and the horse flies into whatever happens next, whether it would be a leg yield or a trot lengthening, or and you see it even at second and third level. It's not isolated to training in first level by any means. But certainly as you approach second level and you're asking for a greater degree of the horse accepting the half halt and being in beginning collection and self-carriage, it can become a bigger issue. I do very simple things. For example, if I ride the corner and I turn onto the diagonal for medium trot, let's say, and I feel that even though the horse waited in the corner, again, here's this diagonal and here we go, I'll ride a transition to halt. Maybe I'll even rein back, so that I'm utilizing movements that this horse knows and exercises that he knows, being a little bit higher level horse, and get him to put his focus back onto me, and then I would trot forward and ride my medium trot. Or I might wait until X to start my medium trot. If you have the opposite problem where the horse is not really very fired up, sometimes I'll start it in the corner, really asking for the medium, so that when the horse comes onto the diagonal, he's really ready to go. So you can, it can work both ways, that you have horses that aren't ambitious and you need to rev them up. But very often it's the opposite and the horse thinks he's in charge and he wants to really go.
Now, what about the horse that comes around the corner, turns across the diagonal, but you're losing that outside shoulder because he's not set up square as he comes out of the corner?
Obviously, that's typically that's a half issue. Your straightness issues usually happen because the horse is losing his balance, so he's not carrying himself equally behind or pushing equally behind. Often, if the rider revisits the half halt and the horse's balance and suppleness through the corner, it becomes less of an issue. But paying attention to how you're utilizing your aids, and again, separating the corner from the turn, makes a big difference. So if you ride the corner, you half halt, you very definitively say, now we're turning onto the diagonal, you have given your horse a much better chance to be straight before you say, okay, let's do whatever it may be. It could be a line of changes. It could be an extended trot, extended canter. Same with, or you may be coming out of the corner and riding half pass, but it would be the same principle that the horse should be waiting for you in terms of how much power you're asking for, how much bend you're asking for, and whether your line of travel is as a half pass or as a straight line in like a medium or an extended canter. Just because I think the trick is keeping the horse waiting on you and not taking off. So any combination of exercises that you can use in your schooling will keep the horse more on your aids in your test riding too.
Right, and paying attention to you, not what he thinks he knows.
Exactly.
Right, terrific. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Vicky.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And now the final part of the evolution of sport horse feeding with Dr. Joe Pagan. This was taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. Dr. Pagan is the founder and president of Kentucky Equine Research.
Now, I've talked about dietary fat quite a bit, and I've told you that there's a lot of good things about adding fat. It's very digestible, potentially a calm energy source. But all we've been talking about with fat up to now has been in terms of fueling muscle contraction. Fats are long chain molecules that basically what happens is they're taken into the muscle, they're chopped up into little bits, and they're burned. And when they're used for that, it doesn't matter what the fat is. It can be vegetable fat, it can be animal fat. It doesn't really matter because you're going to burn them up. And really in the 80s and 90s, when we were talking about feeding fat, we didn't really differentiate very much. But since that time, we have discovered that the type of fat that you're feeding can make a really big difference. And it's not as a source of energy. You've all heard of omega-3 and omega-6 fats, and you've heard of them in the context of your own health about how good omega-3 fats are for you. The same thing is true for horses, and actually it may be more important for certain types of horses than people. The type of fat will greatly affect the omega-3, omega-6 balance. Well, what does omega-3 and omega-6 mean? It's not as different as you might think. Fats are typically long chain. There's about 18 carbons, 18 to 22 carbons that are hooked together. So they're long chain fats, and many of them have double bonds. When you have a double bond, you call it unsaturated. So more than one double bond makes it polyunsaturated. So a long chain polyunsaturated fat is a long fat that's got a bunch of double bonds. Polyunsaturated, long chain, and also polyunsaturated means they're liquid at room temperature. So any of the fats that you can pour out at room temperature are polyunsaturated. The reason this is important is because these fats are used for a lot of functions in the body that don't have anything to do with being broken down to fuel muscle contraction. These are precursors for a lot of other compounds, molecules that are created in the body. These are called eicosanoids, and really what they are is local hormones. These things, thromboxins, prostaglandins, leukotrienes, these are very powerful local hormones that have a very profound effect on a lot of functions in the body. And whether you start with an omega-3 or an omega-6 determines which type of these local hormones you produce. Well, if you look at what they do, the ones that are produced from the omega-3 fats decrease inflammatory response. They decrease the effect of osteoarthritis. They improve bone formation. They decrease allergic hyperactivity. And they decrease exercise-induced bronchioconstriction. Those are all good things. The ones that come from omega-6 do just the opposite. So the balance of whether you have omega-3s or omega-6s makes a big difference about what types of eicosanoids the horse is going to actually produce in its body. What should be the right ratio of these? If you look in nature at green pasture, if a horse is out grazing pasture, it actually has more omega-3 fats than omega-6 fats. So pasture actually has a higher level of omega-3. Grass, hay, and oats has a higher level of omega-6. When hay grows up, matures, and is cured for hay, the concentration of omega-3s drops very dramatically. So you can see that a hay-oat diet has a ratio of 15 times as much omega-6 as omega-3. Add corn to it, and you have a 30-to-1 ratio. If you supplement that with soybean oil, you improve the ratio because soybean oil actually has a moderate concentration of omega-6s. But if you supplement that same diet with corn oil, you have a 50-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. Now, if I had been giving this lecture 10 years ago, I've always said corn oil is the gold standard of vegetable oils. It's highly digestible. Horses like it. Their muscle uses it very well. But I don't say that anymore because corn oil is very high in omega-6s. If you look at the different types of oils, the ones that are high in omega-6, low in omega-3, corn oil, sunflower oil, and safflower oil, these are all bad ratios, if you will. Moderate ratios, soybean oil and canola oil actually have a moderate concentration of these, and the low omega-6 are, conversely, the high omega-3 fats in from vegetable oil is linseed or flaxseed oil. All of these oils are polyunsaturated, and all of them are 18 carbons long. There's one other type of omega-3 oil that's slightly different, and it is high in 20 and 22 carbon omega-3s. That's several steps down the chain. Extra carbons have been added. These so-called long chain omega-3s only come from one place. It's from marine sources, and one of the main ones is fish oil. The reason that that's important is to add on these extra carbons takes an enzyme called an elongase enzyme. And these two pathways share the same enzyme. And so one of the problems, if you have way too much of one type versus the other, is it uses up all the enzyme, so that even if you have linolenic acid, it can't be elongated and therefore can't make these useful prostaglandins. These long-chain fats, long-chain omega fats, skip that step, so you don't have the competition that you have with omega-6. The problem with that is fish oil, traditionally, horses didn't like it very well. In fact, they hated it. It was very smelly. And there was actually some very good research that had been done with fish oil back in the 90s that showed some real benefits. But we tried to do some research with it, and it's just like, get out of here. This stuff is terrible. The horses wouldn't eat it. It'd get all over you. It was a terrible deal. Then there were some improvements in technology that allowed the deodorization of fish oil, the deodorization and flavoring of fish oil. And we found one that we could deodorize and flavor, and we made it into this product called EO3. It's a fish oil, it's a cherry flavored, it's still a little fishy, but in doing palatability studies compared with soybean oil, after about 3 days, the horses couldn't differentiate the two. Between raw fish oil and this, the horses differentiated 100% for as long as we fed it. We wanted to see if the horses could actually absorb this fish oil, so we did some studies that lasted 120 days where we fed 2 ounces of either the fish oil or corn oil, and we looked at the concentration of there's the 20 carbon and the 22 carbon in the horse's blood. This was in blood serum, and you saw that there was a big increase. There was another increase, though, when we looked at the red blood cell, the cell itself. It took a while, but we saw an increase in EPA and DHA in the cell itself. The reason that occurs is all of the membranes in the horse's body, cell membranes, all of the cell membranes in your body are made of fatty acids. And the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 you eat depends, will determine what the ratio in these cell membranes is. So you can actually change the composition of cell membranes by what you feed. In horses, this becomes a big deal because when red blood cells have a high concentration of omega-6 fats in the cell membrane, they become more rigid, less flexible. When you have omega-3 incorporation, cell membranes become more flexible, they become more elastic, and that's one of the reasons that it helps in terms of cardiovascular effects for humans too, is it changes the composition of capillaries, making them more elastic, reducing blood pressure, that sort of thing. So there's a second thing that these fats do. They're actually incorporated into every cell in your body. And then finally, probably the most exciting thing these fats do is their effect on moderating gene expression. There's a real big problem in horses called equine metabolic syndrome. It's kin to type 2 diabetes in humans, and it's a problem that's an endocrine and metabolic disorder that results in insulin resistance. And it's really can be very bad because it increases the risk of pasture-associated laminitis, and it tends to happen in horses that are quite obese with crusty necks, and it tends to happen in horses that are easy keepers. When you feed a horse a meal of grain, the grain is broken down from starch to glucose, and it's absorbed from the small intestine. If you look in the blood over time, you see an increase in blood glucose. So if you take repeated blood samples after a meal, you see an increase. When this blood glucose increases, insulin is produced. It signals the body to produce insulin. The insulin's produced, and that drives this blood glucose into tissues, and the blood glucose comes back down. That's the normal response that you get when you feed. We can do a test where we actually infuse glucose into the horse's blood. If we do an IV glucose tolerance test, we give a higher concentration of blood of glucose into the vein, and you see a big increase in blood glucose. That causes an increase in insulin, and this drives the decrease in glucose. We can check to see if a horse is insulin insensitive or glucose intolerant by doing this type of test. You give them a challenge of glucose, and you see how quickly they can take it out of the blood. We did this after feeding horses two different types of diets. One was a diet that was a regular carbohydrate diet, and one was a really high-fat diet. What these high-fat diets do when you get extreme with high fat is they create a form of inflammation in the horse that mimics obesity, really. When we did this, we saw that when we did glucose challenges on a high-fat diet, we had a delay in terms of the horse's ability to remove glucose from its blood. We did this, and then we looked at the effect of adding corn oil or fish oil to the diet. When we decrease this glucose clearance from the blood by feeding high fat, if we added additionally corn oil, it didn't help. We still had a delay in terms of removing glucose from the body. But when we added fish oil to the diet, you see the horses return completely to normal. And what is happening there is that fish oil is actually upregulating genes in the horse's muscle and its fat to make those tissues more insulin sensitive and insulin responsive. There's been some very eloquent studies that have been done in laboratory animals showing that you can actually upregulate genes that improve insulin sensitivity. The other thing that you're doing is you're treating inflammation, because the omega-3 fats are anti-inflammatory. Horses that have metabolic syndrome, that are obese, have this chronic state of inflammation that makes these tissues insensitive to insulin. So there's another thing that that I think is very interesting, and that's in terms of the effect of these omega fats on target tissues. So I think that if you're going to feed a high-fat diet, it's certainly worth looking at the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. But if you're feeding a high-fat diet, you should also look at the possibility of adding some of these longer-chain omega-3s as a marine-derived source of omega-3. So again, in conclusion, we've changed the way that we fed horses very dramatically. We've gone away from a cereal-based diet to many instances to diets that have no cereals at all, that are high in fat and fermentable fiber. In some horses, that's absolutely essential. If you've got a problem with a horse that ties up, this is something that needs to be done medically. I think we've probably overcorrected there a little bit, though, and there's some horses that don't necessarily need that high a fat and fiber diet that are receiving this. So I would encourage you to first determine the feed that you're using now. Where are you on that spectrum in terms of this mixture of energy sources? And then ask yourself, are you at the right level? What are you trying to accomplish in terms of this balance between athletic performance, behavior, and any type of medical issues that you might have? And then find one that's suitable, that matches your specific horse, stick with it. And I would really encourage you to look at the overall omega-3, omega-6 balance of the fats that you're feeding.
This podcast is available for download on iTunes. Visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education, at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.